I'm Carl Hammerschlag. I am a psychiatrist by training, a community psychiatrist. I'm here in Sioux Falls to talk about the future of healthcare. We are going through some enormous changes, economically, technologically, and certainly politically. The healthcare environment is moving in a direction that is challenging to both patients and practitioners, and we're talking about how it is that we can pursue the Holy Grail, which is controlling costs without compromising quality. And it is my very strong belief that the future of medicine is in the movement from the contemporary paradigm, which is interventional care. You get a diagnosis, you're sick, you go to see somebody who helps you, is not the future of healthcare. It's not the future of medicine. The future of healthcare, the future of medicine, is in the movement from intervention, diagnosis, and treatment to prediction, who's likely to get sick, and prevention. How we can inspire and help people become the principal agents in their own healing.
You were talking to healthcare professionals today. So from their perspective, what do you need to get across to them about changing that mentality from just treating whatever comes up to understanding how to stop people from falling ill?
Every healthcare professional understands that the costs that are implied in interventional care are making it increasingly difficult. There are too many people who have no healthcare. I mean, 50 million uninsured people, another 50 or underinsured, and we continue to have the capacity technologically to do things that were once unimaginable. We are keeping people alive, we're living longer, we are moving in a direction in which the costs of healthcare are crippling us. Medicare will essentially run out by 2030 unless we make some changes. The important issues in terms of health are that the demographics are changing. People are getting older. People are not waiting until they get sick to want to take steps to live healthier. And we need to help those people take those steps. Instead of having patients place themselves solely in the hands of providers, doctors, when they are sick, we need to inspire people to take those steps before they get sick.
An important facet that you mention in your talk is the fact that we have so many people that are being diagnosed with so many things that you touched on, physical and mental health. Talk to me about that. It's a good thing to know that people have conditions and to try to treat them, but there's certainly a problem with that, as you explain.
Well, we don't know what those conditions are. When we talk about mental health, I suggested that 25% of all Americans carry a mental illness diagnosis. In this country, if you're feeling anything other than wonderful in every moment, you could be suffering from a disease. We are bombarded with television advertisements on virtually every program, from major sports events to any soap opera, that says if you are shy, you could have a social anxiety disorder. If you're feeling sad, you could be depressed. If you are tired at the end of the day, you could require something that wakes you up. There is a pill virtually for everything. And you want to see your doctor. And of course, doctors are visited by pharmaceutical salesmen who promote the idea that somehow there is a pill for everything that ails you. Just because you're sad doesn't mean you're clinically depressed. It's important not to take a pill. It's important to deal with what it is that makes you depressed, because at some time in the future, you're going to get depressed again. Learn ways to deal with it. We are becoming a culture in which we are becoming increasingly chemical dependent. And I suggested that this is happening not only with adults, but with children. We have increased, for example, the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder with or without hyperactivity at least 30-fold in the last 20 years. We have an epidemic of attention deficit disorder. Young children prescribed drugs for a disease which is difficult to define. So sometimes it's hyperactive and sometimes it's not. Kids are having difficulty in tracking, paying attention, in staying focused. They act out in schools. You know, in the old days, these kids were set limits, but we live in a culture in which the setting of limits has become increasingly difficult. We expect teachers to do it when parents who both have to work because the economy can't sustain just one parent working don't have time to enforce those controls. Teachers who are dramatically underpaid are asked to take care of kids, and when they can't because they have too many kids in their classrooms, send them to somebody who will evaluate these children and say, well, why don't we try something? The long-term effects of these drugs are unclear. We know that the increase in the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder happened to come simultaneously with the discovery of medications used to treat it. That can't just be an accident. And of course, this research is done by psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, many of whom, by the way, had a vested interest in getting pharmaceutical companies to find a market for their drugs because they support their research and keep schools of medicine and departments alive. The point is that one in every seven children in this country now is developmentally disabled, most of it because of the rise of the epidemic in attention deficit disorder. The long-term effect of those pills are unclear, and the diagnosis is fuzzy at best.
And from your talk, I discern that that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as a child who has attention deficit disorder, but it's a matter of the fact that we are doling out so many diagnoses that concerns you more.
Exactly right. I mean, there may be some children who really have a serious problem, but the idea that somehow one out of seven children has a serious problem, it seems to me, is unreasonable and probably far more reflects a culture in which parents are older when they're having children, both of them may be working. It's difficult to set limits in contemporary life, even though we know that the setting of limits is an ego-corrective experience. You can't always get what you want, like that old tune. You can't always get what you want. But we live in a culture in which the anticipation is if you want it, you can get it. And everybody ought to have it, and immediately. And if you don't, then somehow you're just not trying hard enough.
That's a hard line to walk between the fact that we need patients to be more accountable for their own health. At the same time, we need to make sure that the institution is being responsible in its diagnosis. So sometimes it sounds a little contradictory to say, well, I need to fight for my health. But that doesn't mean that I see an ad on TV for a pharmaceutical and I go in and ask for it. There's a line there, and it's kind of fuzzy.
Well, I think that we're making it fuzzy. The truth is that the media is suggesting that if you're feeling anything other than wonderful in every moment, you could be suffering from a disease. Check with your doctor. Nobody is feeling wonderful in every moment. And doctors don't have a lot of time to spend with patients, because time is not a reimbursable commodity. And if a patient comes in saying, listen, this is how I feel, there may be a pill out there, it's easier to prescribe it than not, even though we don't know what the long-term consequences are of these medications, especially on young children. And sadly, even if the medicines don't work, doctors are encouraging certainly children to keep taking them, or their parents, because perhaps the kids will get worse if they stop taking it. We need to get away from the mentality that somehow if you give something a name and there is a pill for it, that somehow you know what it is you're doing. I call this the Rumpelstiltskin syndrome. You give it a name and somehow that means you know what's going on. And I'm telling you, we don't. There is enormous variability. People in Sioux Falls don't diagnose it in the same way as people in New Orleans or New York or in Los Angeles. We don't have enough child psychiatrists. All of the things that are being advertised on television are suggesting that somehow it may work. We are dramatically overworked, and we don't have a lot of time. It's easier to get sucked in. I lament that.
And you say there's a fundamental change happening in healthcare, regardless of some of the major legislation that's been passed. You say that healthcare, as we know it, is changing. What's it changing to?
Healthcare has got to change because we simply can't afford to give everybody everything and all the time. And we probably don't need to. We are over-diagnosing, we are over-prescribing, and we are reimbursed for procedures and bills rather than prevention. 85% of most of the cost of healthcare goes in the treatment of chronic disease. We don't do well in chronic disease. We do well in acute disease, acute infectious disease, acute trauma. Chronic disease means changes in behaviors. People have to live and do things differently. We need to inspire people to be able to do that. And in healthcare, we don't have time to inspire patients anymore. We hardly have time to talk to them, much less to have relationships. That paradigm has to change if we are to intensify our power to heal. And we are moving away from being healers. The concerns about reimbursement and bottom line are changing what it is we do into just another industry. Healthcare is not an industry. Nobody comes into this because it's a business. Healthcare is a ministry. It reminds us what ennobles the human spirit, to reach out to people to help them in their difficulties. If we continue to pursue only the bottom line, then it steals from us what is the essence of our healing power.
This week you speak to the institutions, but what can regular South Dakotans take away from this? We have a big healthcare law that's got a lot into it. We have big healthcare institutions. Sometimes when people are living their daily lives, working, taking care of their kids, running their errands, it just seems really overwhelming. What can real people do to change the way that their healthcare is going?
Real people, like you and I, Keely, need to learn to eat better. We need to learn to stress less. We need to find a way to exercise more because it will keep us healthier. We need to drink less, and we need to stop smoking. That's what ordinary people can do. We need to take steps that we know are going to allow us to share the gift of who we are with our kids and grandkids. And we are getting older. Demographically, we're just going to live longer. If you want to live longer and stay healthier, you have to become the principal agent in the maintenance of your health. Instead of laying down, waiting to get sick, and then going to your doctor if you're feeling something, and then beginning to take steps. We need to feed our kids better in schools. We need to stop perpetuating the idea that epidemic obesity can be treated by giving children statin drugs in order to lower their cholesterol. We need all to take responsibility for taking steps in maintaining our health.
I really enjoyed one of your anecdotes, so I'd like to finish up with this. You explained to about 700 people that at one point you dressed up as a toilet. So if you could just recap that a little bit for our audience and give us the message that you really delivered with that, what the point of dressing up as a toilet and wandering around the Mall of America really was for you.
In addition to being a physician, I am also a clown, and I work with a dear and close friend, Patch Adams, perhaps the world's most recognized humanitarian clown. I suggested that the important thing in healthcare was that we had to retain a sense of humor, and that the greatest act of revolution in contemporary American health was to find a way to come to every day with joy, because healthcare legislation, the political atmosphere, the uncertainty about the Affordable Care Act, whether it will be terminated as the first act of a new president, is stealing from us our joy. And that it was critically important to remember that the gift that we have to give people is the gift of the essence of our heart and soul, not just what we know, but who we are. And joy touches the heart, allows us to come to people with an open heart. So my friend Patch had a costume of a toilet. I went to visit him, and I saw it, and I said, oh, I have to wear this, because this is what I do professionally. I am a toilet. I'm a psychiatrist. People come to dump on me. So I put on this toilet costume and went to a mall with Patch, where we were going to buy some white shoes to go along with this costume. And the point was that the only people who came up to this toilet were kids who were not afraid of toilets or anything that sounded like one, and that the critical issue was to remind ourselves that we need to get out there, separate ourselves from our heads, get into our hearts, our joyful hearts, and reach out and touch each other in ways that remind us of our best selves, instead of presenting ourselves in ways that continue to remind us of our least desired selves, that we don't have time, that we can't connect, that life and practice are stealing our joy and takes from us our ability to connect with people in ways that remind us of our shared humanity.
Dr. Hammerslag, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Kelly. Nice to be with you.